In this video, I'm going to be making the counterintuitive argument that in some cases, local monopolies can produce superior outcomes to free market competition. My case study for this will be US pro wrestling from about 1970 to 2001. Now, I should say that this video is about economics, not about wrestling per se. And if you'd like to learn more on the wrestling side of things, let me know in the comments and maybe I can do a stream on it. But here we are focused on the effects of an anti-competitive cartel. With that said, it will be necessary to give some details on the pro wrestling side for any of this to make sense. So here goes. From 1948 until the mid-1980s, pro wrestling in the United States was dominated by the National Wrestling Alliance, which was, in effect, a cartel of promoters who had made non-compete agreements with each other to stick to their respective territories, somewhat like mafia dons who each had their own turf. Here is a picture of the scene in the 1970s. I will talk through some of these territories in a moment, but first it is worth outlining how the cartel operated. Effectively, every promotion would stick to their defined limits, only promoting their own cards on a regular loop within its territory. Every territory would usually have one big key venue with whom they'd own an exclusive contract, often running for many, many years. For example, Frank Tunney owned the exclusive rights to promote wrestling at Maple Leaf Gardens, I think from the mid-50s all the way to Jack Tunney's death, which was, top of my head, I think around about 2004, something like that. Anyway, this key venue would then act as a linchpin for the bigger shows in the area, and the promotion would also run smaller towns around the loop. Every territory would usually have its own television slot also, sometimes just local TV, but sometimes also nationally syndicated and even on cable. More on that in a moment. Now, during this period, there would sometimes spring up so-called outlaw promotions who would run without the blessing of the NWA and even dare to run towns against an NWA promotion. When this would happen, the NWA would kick into gear. Wrestlers who worked for outlaws might get themselves blacklisted or perhaps get a visit from one of the well-known backstage enforcers and receive the beating of their life. The local NWA promoter would run a card in the same town on the same night as the outlaw, and all of the other promoters in the country would send their top talent to absolutely load up the card to ensure that any and all wrestling fans in that area would go to see the NWA show and not the outlaw show. Effectively, outlaws would tend to get run out of town fast. The NWA operated like the mafia. Now, it's worth noting that although this was a cartel which produced all these local monopolies, it was not backed by any government or state power. It was a true robber baron style cartel, and as we will see, as Murray Rothbard would predict, it would not last without such state backing. More on that in a moment. First of all, let's just have a flavour. I'm going to give you a small flavour of each of the territories. We're going to have a whirlwind tour around them. The head honcho of the NWA, Sam Muchnick, was based in the St. Louis office, which was seen as the most prestigious town to work, and it was a mainstay of the NWA champion. Their key venue was the Keel, and they had a very good TV spot called Wrestling at the Chase, which went all the way back to the 1950s. Muchnick wanted to present wrestling as a pure, legit sport, so St. Louis was very big on technical, catch-as-catch-can style wrestling and featured almost no gimmicks or gimmick matches. The Northeast was controlled by the WWWF under Vince McMahon Sr., and Madison Square Garden was seen as the biggest payday in wrestling. The WWWF was the biggest territory, as you can see from this map, and its major star was Bruno Sammartino. But it was still a member of the NWA, and the NWA world champion would sometimes come to Madison Square Garden for a title defense, or even sometimes a champion versus champion match. The WWWF was a big man territory, featuring slow, punch-kick orientated action. The Mid-Atlantic territory was controlled by Jim Crockett Sr. It was renowned for its hot crowds and highly athletic, fast-paced style of work. Ric Flair and Ricky the Dragon Steamboat both made their names here. It was seen as a, quote, work rate territory, and the booker, George Scott, would give workers bonuses for putting on the best matches they possibly could. Its key venue was the Greensboro Coliseum. Georgia was run by Jim Barnett, which was known for having a big TV show on WTBS called World Championship Wrestling, which was bankrolled by Ted Turner, who was a big Southern wrestling fan. Georgia TV featured hot angles, which blew off at supercards at the legendary Omni. Florida was run by Eddie Graham, known for being a genius of storylines and for being a great finish guy. That is, he would come up with ingenious endings to matches. Their big stars included Jack Briscoe and Dusty Rhodes. Their key venue was the Bayfront Center in St. Petersburg. Detroit was controlled by the Sheik, who was also its top star. Unusually for a territory, he was a heel, who'd often get himself disqualified to hold on to his belt, much to the chagrin of fans. The key venue for Detroit was the Cobo Arena. San Francisco was run by Roy Scheider, who was also seen as a genius within the business. Its biggest stars were Ray Stevens and Pat Patterson, and its key venue was the Cow Palace. LA, meanwhile, was promoted by Mike LaBelle, and its key star was Fred Blassie. Some of you may remember him as the manager, Classy Freddie Bessie, later in his career. LA was known for booking a lot of gimmicks, and also for featuring luchadors from Mexico. Its key venue was the Grand Olympic Auditorium. Dory Funk Sr. promoted Amarillo, a huge territory in West Texas. His sons, both massive stars around the world, that is Terry and Dory Funk Jr., were his key stars. Fritz Von Erich had the territory around Dallas, and much like Dory Sr., he booked his sons as the top stars as he wound down in the ring. Their key venue was the Dallas Sportatorium. Now, there were other territories too. Don Owen in Portland, Stu Hart in Calgary, that's Bret and Owen Hart's father, of course, Frank Tunney in Toronto. If you were a fan of the WWF in the 1980s, you'd probably know his brother, Jack Tunney. He was the on-air president. In fact, he was just a backstage promoter who would promote shows up at the Maple Leaf Gardens. Bob Geigel ran Central States, based out of Kansas. Harley Race was the big star there. And of course, there was Vern Gagne, who ran the AWA, a huge area across the Midwest. His top star was Nick Bockwinkel, one of the greatest ever to lace them up. Now, the AWA was not affiliated with the NWA, but nonetheless, no one would run shows in Vern's patch. And he was on such friendly terms with the other NWA promoters that the AWA was a member of the NWA in all but name. Now, as I'm sure many of you know, this whole system came crashing down when a certain Vince McMahon Jr. took over his father's company with a plan for world domination and to revolutionize wrestling. He immediately pulled out of the NWA and aggressively raided talent from other companies. First, he went after Vern Gagne and the AWA, poaching almost all of their top stars, including Hulk Hogan. He expanded into LA and San Francisco, which had been vacated for a couple of years at that point. He started loading up cards up and down the country, going head to head with the local NWA offices, who had been not used to any sort of competition at all for decades. He poached the coveted WTBS slot from Georgia Championship Wrestling, although the result was famously a disaster, and made him a lifelong enemy of Ted Turner. He acquired the St. Louis Wrestling at the Chase TV slot, forcing lifelong wrestling fans in St. Louis to watch WWF stars instead of the sort of pure wrestling action that they had been used to. As a result of all of this, by 1986, the NWA was falling apart, and its remaining offices started to centralize. Jim Crockett Promotions, which had run the Mid-Atlantic area, merged with Georgia Championship Wrestling, and soon after bought the Florida office too, as well as Mid-South Wrestling from Cowboy Bill Watts and all its wrestlers and TV slots. In 1988, Ted Turner himself then bought Jim Crockett Promotions to create WCW. And very quickly, wrestling had gone from this colourful map to a straight two-horse race between Vince McMahon's WWF and Ted Turner's WCW. This came to a head in the 1990s during the Monday Night Wars, and in the end, Vince McMahon won, buying out WCW in 2001 and all its assets. He finally achieved national domination of wrestling with all other competitors eliminated. I should note that this is exactly what Murray Rothbard would have predicted in his theory of monopoly, which says that in the absence of state protections, a private cartel like the NWA would eventually be broken by a renegade capitalist like Vince McMahon. However, it was not so much broken by the power of the market and by the power of consumer decisions, but rather by Vince's own bloody-minded competitiveness and vision to take wrestling first national and then global. He did many, many things to give his competitors a bloody nose, which I don't have the time to go into here. I am going to be arguing that wrestling was better and in a healthier state when it had the anti-competitive local monopolies than after McMahon took over the world. My argument is threefold. First, quantity, that is the total number of wrestling cards available to the ticket-buying public. Second, quality, which is to say the fitness of product to specific audiences. And third, community, which is to say wrestling's contribution to local cultures. So let's start on quality. It just so happens that wrestling fans are some of the nerdiest on the internet, which is saying something. And there exists this massive database of results and attendance figures called Wrestling Data. For example, here are all the cards promoted by Bob Geigel in the Central States office in November and December 1974. I can click on any one of these cards and see who was wrestling on it, the average age of the wrestlers, where it was held, and if data is available, the attendance numbers. So here we can see this card at the Kiel in St. Louis drew just over 5,100 people. Disappointing for a crowd at the Kiel, but then looking at the card, it is pretty weak. A more loaded card, like this one for example, could draw more than double that in the same time period. As you can see, that one had 10,800 people at it. So what I've done using all this data is to calculate how many shows each company promoted in three key six-year periods. So from 1970 to 1975 in the peak of the NWA era, from 1985 to 1990 in the peak of the Hogan era, and then from 1996 to 2001 during the Monday Night Wars. Each of these were periods when wrestling was thought to be hot. The business goes in peaks and troughs, but these were undoubtedly three peak periods. Incidentally, the periods in between, so let's say 76 to 82 or so, 91 to about 95 are trough periods, okay? Just for the interest of fairness, I thought, well, I'll pick three peak periods to represent three different eras, okay? Now, you can see that some territories, notably Mid-Atlantic and Florida, were running over 500 shows a year in the 1970s. This was an extremely healthy wrestling economy for both fans and the wrestlers. If you were a fan, you'd likely get wrestling in a town near you once or twice a week, and you'd have to wait no longer than a month. If you were a wrestler, you had at least 17 potential employers to work for, and this list is not by any means exhaustive, and neither does it include Japanese promotions, who also gave big paydays to American stars. Most stars would come into a territory, work a hot feud, and then leave after a blow-off match so they didn't get stale, and then it was on to the next territory. They'd go to one place for 3 months, 6 months, and then they'd be on to the next one. This meant that their act was always fresh in front of new fans. For the TV watcher, depending on where you were, you had a great deal of choice, although I should note that most wrestling TV shows in those days were more of a commercial to get fans to go to the next big live show than they were an actual product in itself. A lot of the promoters at the time would not give away big matches on live TV. They wanted people to come out to the arena. That was the business model. And this was one of those things that Vince McMahon changed. Now, if you were a fan in a territory, you'd get a big show at least once every month. But most places ran either weekly or bi-weekly. For example, let's just take one example. Between 1970 and 1975, Roy Shire ran the Cow Palace near San Francisco 96 times. After the WWF took over promoting the Cow Palace in the 80s, it ran it only 40 times. And remember, WF were hot in that period, only 40 times in 6 years. By the Monday Night Wars, WCW were running the Cow Palace, and they ran it only 9 times. And several of those were big pay-per-view shows, hence the slightly higher average gates that you can see. But also, remember, fans in that area would have been starved for wrestling content. So, you know, I guess a different way of looking at it would be, well, hold on a second. They ran 9 shows. They couldn't sell them all out. But anyway, that's a different point. You can see that the total number of shows at the Cow Palace has diminished dramatically. And you can do this exercise with practically any major venue in the country and tell the same story. Some of these were legendary wrestling venues, and you know, by the late 90s, they were lucky to get a show a year when they had been running every week or every other week or at the very least once a month. But you can see the bigger picture from the macro stats that I've put here. In the late 90s, many fewer shows total were run during the Monday Night Wars than during the 1970s. In fact, if you work it out, there was a staggering 91% reduction in live shows between the two eras, literally down from almost 39,000 in the 70s to just under 3,500 there in the 90s. Now, granted, there are some other factors at play here. The advent of the pay-per-view business model, Vince McMahon's heavy focus on the television product, and the fact he frequently gave away big matches on TV for free. All of these things had made the live show business less profitable by the 1990s. But I think it's easy to see, just looking at these stats, that business did better overall under anti-competitive cartel conditions with local monopolies than under free competition. More people got to see more shows, more wrestlers got to work and support their families, and more companies stayed in business, ultimately. So I think the picture in the 70s is healthier than the picture in the 90s. So let me move on now to the quality argument. Quality is, of course, subjective, and this is in no way meant as a slight on Vince McMahon, who I personally consider to be a genius of both. He's both a creative genius and a marketing genius. And I reckon probably he's approaching a unique American icon status. You know, I was thinking about this the other day, that maybe Vince McMahon is almost like a Walt Disney level person at this point. But that's a different topic. But there can be no doubt that the average wrestling fan in 1987 was served worse than the average fan in 1973. Why? Because, as I said, each territory had its own unique feel and its own unique flavor suited to its area and the tastes of the fans in that area. Fans in the Carolinas, like I said, preferred faster-paced action. Fans in Texas liked death matches and brass knuckle fights and things like that. Now, all wrestling fans, no matter where they were forced to take the same product. And the WWF was not to many older fans' tastes, especially as it was marketed to children to sell action figures. Finally, let us discuss community. Some of those old territorial promotions would promote shows week in, week out, month after month. There was a whole culture and way of life suited to that area, built up around this tradition of wrestling at this venue or at that venue. And that came with a whole set of values as well. For example, they didn't like sissies down in the Mid-South. Famously, Bill Watts, who I mentioned earlier, ran an angle where Jim Cornette was tarred and feathered for being a mummy's boy and a sissy. They didn't need any New York types down in Texas, and so on and so forth. But now, the entirety of the product was New York through and through. Now, if those old monopolies had been state-backed and not just privately upheld, Vince McMahon would have had to remain penned in by his father's old territory. The traditional ways would have persevered, at least longer than they did. And the average wrestling fan wouldn't have to wait once in a blue moon to get Monday Night Raw in their area. You know, they'd have to wait an age for WWE to come to town these days to see major stars at a live show. So I submit that sometimes there could be circumstances in which a hard restriction on doing business which would maintain a local monopoly could work for the benefit of the consumer and for the greater good of the community. Let me know your thoughts. I realise this is an anti-libertarian argument. Let me know if you think there's anything I've missed. And I'm looking forward to watching the discussion. Hopefully this will spark something. Till next time. Are you sick of hearing about Marx and Keynes? Do you want to know why neoclassical economics is so flawed? Have you ever wondered how to work out the marginal productivity of a burger bun? Do you want to level up your econ knowledge? Buy it now. £350. Foundations of Economics. Foundations of Economics.
I'm here.
Foundations of Economics. Get it now. Be sure to like this video and subscribe. And if you really like my content, maybe consider joining the channel or donating or maybe even buy a mug. I am grateful for all of your support. Now get out.